After the movie Free Willy became a hit, word got out that the star of the film, a killer whale named Keiko, was sick and still living in a tiny pool in a Mexican amusement park. Fans were outraged. Kids demanded his release. I'm Daniel Alarcón. From Serial Productions and the New York Times comes The Good Whale, a story about the wildly ambitious science experiment to return Keiko to the ocean. Listen to new episodes on Thursdays. Want early access to the whole show? Subscribe to The Times at nytimes.com/podcasts to listen on Apple Podcasts and Spotify.
From the New York Times, I'm Michael Barbaro. This is The Daily. Today, Foreign Service agents often serve for decades, carrying their knowledge and relationships from one administration to the next. But in a few short months, a new boss has fired or driven out many of the country's most experienced diplomats. The state of the State Department under Rex Tillerson. It's Friday, October 20th.
You mind if I record?
Yeah, no, that's fine.
Okay.
Jason Zangerli recently sat down with Secretary of State Rex Tillerson.
He's big. He's somewhat, you know, sort of barrely. His hair is, you know, combed back in this kind of Master of the Universe style. And he's got this voice.
Well, there's a lot of things going on, so I have to decide.
He's just got this kind of deep baritone with this Texas accent, and it really radiates a kind of charisma and authority. His presence is one you feel when you're in it.
Take a map of the world out, throw a dart.
Did you just get back from the White House?
Yeah, had some lunch.
What was on
got
the
map? Got back, had lunch. But yeah, I was over there for a couple of hours.
So Tillerson's different from other cabinet members in the White House. Is that right? I mean, how does he stand out?
Well, he has a real record of accomplishment in the business world. You know, Tillerson, he started at Exxon as right out of college, right out of the University of Texas, as an engineer. And he spent 41 years there and worked his way up the ladder to eventually become CEO.
I had a fantastic 41 and a half year career at Exxon. I am the most blessed person on planet Earth. Loved every minute of it.
Trump was really enamored of the idea that ExxonMobil was in the toughest places in the world, and Tillerson was dealing with the toughest people and getting the best of them in his negotiations. And Trump really, he thought those skill sets could really be brought to bear for his administration. I do think Trump was impressed that he was a self-made man.
And what do you mean by self-made man?
He grew up, his father worked for the Boy Scouts. He did not grow up rich. He went to the University of Texas as an engineer and started as an engineer and then climbed his way up the corporate ladder and became a multimillionaire. He's not someone who started with the advantages that, say, you know, Donald Trump or Steve Mnuchin had. He really was a self-creation.
Well, you probably know the story. He and I had never met before the day he asked me to do this.
Yeah.
So remind us how Tillerson got this coveted position, arguably the most prestigious cabinet position in any White House Secretary of State. Why him?
Well, Trump, I think, was having a real difficult time deciding who he wanted for the job. In the initial days, some of the people being mentioned were John Bolton and Newt Gingrich and Rudy Giuliani. All three were quite strident critics of the State Department. So the idea that they would then be running it would be troubling, I think, for people there. And then right around that time, he had a meeting with Robert Gates, who was the Secretary of Defense under President Obama. And Gates had been quite critical of Trump during the campaign, as many mainstream Republicans had been. But Trump saw him nonetheless, and it was during that meeting at Trump Tower that Gates recommended Tillerson for the job of Secretary of State.
Well, I know a number of former Secretary of States. Well, I've known Jim Baker for many, many years. Condoleezza Rice and I have been friends for a long time. Essentially all of the living Secretary of States. Mm-hmm.
Gates had worked as a consultant for ExxonMobil along with Condoleezza Rice, who also around the same time was recommending Tillerson. So based on those recommendations, Trump reached out to Tillerson's people and invited him up to New York for a meeting. As I understand it, Tillerson thought he was going up just to talk about foreign policy. He did not realize that he was going up to be interviewed to be Secretary of State. And in their first meeting at Trump Tower, I think it went 2 hours, which is an eternity for a meeting for President Trump. Trump was just blown away by Tillerson. I talked to Steve Bannon, mm-hmm. and he said that as soon as Tillerson walked in the door, as soon as Bannon saw Tillerson, you know, he could see his presence, his charisma, and he knows how much first impressions matter to Trump. And he said he knew as soon as Tillerson walked in the door that he had the job.
Meaning that Trump had a physical vision of what his Secretary of State might look like and sound like.
I think so. And if he didn't have a physical vision before, he did after he saw Tillerson. Apparently, he offered him the job in the interview.
Wow.
Towards the end of my career, President Trump elects, presents me with this. You know, that's when my wife made me realize I hadn't done anything yet. Mm-hmm. And she said, look, you've been training for this for 40 years. You got to go do it.
I mean, you could argue that Tillerson in some ways had a leg up over his predecessors in terms of what he knew about the world, at least parts of the world. You know, he had deep experience in the Middle East and in Africa and in Latin America, given the work he'd done there on behalf of ExxonMobil. But he knew absolutely nothing about the State Department itself or even government. There's a real sense inside the State Department and among Foreign Service officers that Tillerson has no use for their expertise, and then in fact he's contemptuous of it.
Tell me about Nancy McEldowney.
She was a career Foreign Service person. I think she'd been in for 30 years. And when Tillerson came in, she at that time was running the Foreign Service Institute, which is where Foreign Service officers go for training. So she, in some ways, was sort of the academic dean of the Foreign Service.
I come from a military family. Mm-hmm. My father was a Marine. My husband and brother were Air Force officers. Patriotism and public service is something that we all care very deeply about. I used to pinch myself and say, I can't believe they pay me to do this, because I got to do things that I was really passionate about. I got to learn new languages, live in different countries around the world, meet fascinating people, and work on things that really mattered.
And what year did you start at the State Department?
Actually, I started under President Reagan in 1986 as a Presidential Management Fellow. And then 2 years later, I entered the Foreign Service.
When you learned that Rex Tillerson was going to be your new boss, the new Secretary of State, what were your first thoughts about that?
When Rex Tillerson was first appointed, all of us were a bit surprised. He had never worked foreign policy. He did not know how government process works. Mm-hmm. And he didn't have relationships really of any kind with people in the White House or with other members of the cabinet. So on those three key areas of policy, process, and people, he was starting behind the curve.
And then what was your experience once he actually started the job?
Rex Tillerson came in and made an initial very positive impression. He appeared to reach out to the workforce of the Department of State, and so people were very optimistic. That optimism did not last long, however.
What do you mean by that?
Well, from the beginning, when we got word that senior people were being fired without any notice or any justification, and there were waves of removals where our senior most officials, the people that we were working for and mm-hmm. taking guidance from, were told after decades of loyal public service, they had 24 or 48 hours to clear out their offices. That, of course, is deeply demoralizing for everyone who worked with and under those individuals. But then when the decision came that our budget was going to be cut by one-third, or that a chokehold was going to be put on our recruitment programs, and people started to ask questions, why is this happening? Why are these things being done? And no answer was provided, or no coherent answer.
And how did the changes under Tillerson affect you personally?
One immediate impact is that my budget was cut. I was told that I could not hire anyone, even when I had vacant positions. I could not transfer people within my organization or from elsewhere inside the State Department. But I was also told that I could make no reference to the policies of the prior administration.
Wait, what?
We were told that memos that would go forward could not reference the policies of the Obama administration. There was a political appointee sent out to the Foreign Service Institute who reviewed our training materials and objected when there was reference to American foreign policy under the Obama administration.
Why do you think that was?
I think it was simply an attempt to state that history started on the day the Trump administration walked into office. Our response was that we were not rewriting history. We would indeed continue to teach our diplomats what policy under all previous presidents had been, and that when the Trump administration developed a policy toward different parts of the world, we would teach that as well.
Wow.
We were told when our materials were reviewed that we should not feature or include materials that discussed the policies of the Obama administration. I objected to that and refused to oblige.
And what happened when you refused to oblige?
I decided to leave in June of this year. I went through a period of weeks and months of soul searching, of consulting with family and trusted friends, of talking with colleagues. None of us, myself and others who have left or are in the process of leaving, we didn't want to leave. We wanted to continue to serve our country, but we had to stay true to our values.
So you decided that you couldn't do the job that you had come to do, and that's when you decided.
That's correct.
To leave.
My effectiveness and the effectiveness of my organization was greatly diminished. It's like the diplomatic equivalent of an earthquake or a fire. When there is a crisis and people will say, where are the firemen? Where are the first responders? And the response will have to be, oh, we decided to get rid of them in a budget-cutting exercise. Because when you think about what America's diplomats do, we are essentially the first line of defense for our country around the world. We provide the early warning indications if a conflict is going to break out. We help build coalitions. We negotiate agreements on everything from counterterrorism to preventing the proliferation of dangerous weapons. And without that first line of defense, America is weaker and more vulnerable, and the world is more dangerous.
My colleague, Jason, spoke with Secretary Tillerson recently in his office and asked him if he was trying to dismantle the Foreign Service.
A question that I've been hearing a lot talking to people in the building and outside, are you trying to dismantle or hollow out the Foreign Service?
And Tillerson said,
far from it.
Okay.
No, I mean, in the time, you know, and I knew this coming into the position, but I've gained even a greater appreciation for it since I got here in terms of the, you know, the level of expertise that people in the Foreign Service have, but also the civil servants here. Mm-hmm. You know, everyone has their role to play.
Do you understand at all why that perception exists? I mean, are there things that you've done that you could see as feeding that perception?
No, I'm mystified by it. And I really am.
Do you, and from your conversations with your former colleagues, do they think that Secretary Tillerson is in some ways trying to dismantle the Foreign Service?
What I heard throughout my tenure while I was there and what I have heard subsequently is rhetoric which says we're trying to make the State Department more effective. But what undermines that rhetoric and causes people not to trust it is the fact that there's no vision, no clarity about what they believe the State Department should be doing, what capabilities and functions should it be performing. The idea that there's some sort of grand strategy behind this, some vision for the role that the Department of State will play in executing the Trump administration policy, none of that is there. all we see are budget cuts, workforce reductions, suspensions of long-standing, greatly cherished programs. So I don't spend a lot of time listening to rumor or conjuring up wild theories, but I'm confused. What direction does Rex Tillerson think he is taking the State Department in that will prove to be in any way positive?
I'm an engineer by training. I'm a very systems, process, methodical decision maker. He's an entrepreneur, different mindset. He makes decisions differently. It doesn't mean one's better than the other, but I've had to learn how he processes information and how I can give him good advice that makes sense to him.
So, Jason, what have you learned about how both the president and Tillerson are thinking about the State Department?
Trump, I gather, in a number of his meetings, both with Tillerson, with Mattis, with other national security officials, had expressed a lot of skepticism and confusion about why America was in all of these places. Why do we have military assets? Why do we have diplomatic assets? Why do we have intelligence assets in all these places? So finally in July, Mattis and Tillerson and some other national security officials set up a meeting with President Trump at the Pentagon, which the Associated Press did a great article about. And the way the Associated Press put it was the meeting was basically a tutorial in American Power 101, just trying to answer the president's, you know, fairly elementary questions about why do we have bases here? Why do we have embassies in these places? And they walked him through with, you know, PowerPoint slides and maps and things like that to just kind of answer these really basic questions. NBC News later reported that it was after that meeting.
Rex Tillerson took the unusual step yesterday of appearing before cameras at the State Department to answer questions about whether he had insulted the president and considered resigning.
That Tillerson voiced his assessment that
he called the president a moron.
The president was a moron.
And what was the president's reaction to that?
It was fake news. It was a totally phony story.
The president called it fake news, but at the same time, he said that if Tillerson did say that, that they would have an IQ test, and he knows who would win that one.
And Jason, to answer the question that the president seemed to be posing in that meeting, why does the U.S. have these bases and embassies all over the place?
It's interesting. The message that, as I understand it, the message that Tillerson and Mattis and others gave to the president was we have these bases and these embassies and the like to help American businesses in their work abroad, because they thought that was a message that would resonate with President Trump. You know, of course, that's only part of it. I mean, we have these bases, we have these embassies because we are the linchpin of global stability, and that's the way it's been for more than the last half century. And without the United States in these places, I think there's the fear that it will be chaos. And I think Tillerson himself believes that. But given the administration he's working in and given some of his own, I think, blind spots in terms of how he's doing his job, that's now being called into question.
President Trump's foreign policy goals break the mold of what people traditionally think is achievable on behalf of our country. We're finding new ways to govern that deliver new victories.
Jason, you probably watched this news conference, I did, where Tillerson came out at the State Department and seemed to basically pledge his loyalty to Trump and to talk about his admiration for Trump. What did you think when you watched that? What did you see?
I saw a guy who knew that his boss was on an airplane going to Las Vegas and knew that the TVs were going to be on that airplane and wanted to make sure that his boss saw him pledge his loyalty.
Let me tell you what I've learned about this president, whom I did not know before taking this office. He loves his country. He puts Americans and America first. He's smart.
One of the weirder press conferences I've ever seen. I mean, the place where he had it, it's a room actually right outside where I met with Tillerson. It's the reception room where Tillerson, every Secretary of State traditionally, that's where they meet with foreign leaders.
Right.
And to see him having to field a question about whether he called the president a moron, it was really surreal.
The president likes to communicate directly with the world in these very unmediated ways on social media. And that appears to have been a source of some tension with the Secretary of State. How does Tillerson talk about that to you, and how does he incorporate that into his job?
It was really fascinating to hear him refer to President Trump's tweets as this sort of unknown external factor. You know, like one morning you can wake up and there's been a nuclear test in North Korea. The next morning you wake up and the president, his boss, has tweeted something.
Look, on the president's tweets, and I've said this to many people before, I take what the president tweets out as his form of communicating, and I build it in to my strategies and my tactics. Mm-hmm. How can I use that? How do I want to use that?
How do you use that?
And in a dynamic situation like we deal with here all the time, and you can go walk around the world, they're all dynamic. Things happen. Things, you wake up the next morning, something's happened. The president's got a tweet out there. So I think about, okay, that's a new condition. How do I want to use that?
Mm-hmm. As best you can tell, Jason, does Rex Tillerson want to be Donald Trump's Secretary of State?
That's a great question. I don't think he wants to be a failure at this point. I don't know if he necessarily wants to be Trump's Secretary of State, but I don't think he wants to leave under the cloud that he's currently operating under. In some ways, if he did want to leave before, the events of the last few weeks have made his departure in some ways less attractive to him because the circumstances around it would be so damaging to his own personal legacy. He's really digging in some ways. He wants to, you know, reestablish and prove his value to Trump.
Is America's chief diplomat's biggest job right now forging diplomacy with his boss?
Yes. And it's his most difficult job.
Jason, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Oh, thanks so much for having me on.
For more of Jason's interview with Rex Tillerson, listen to this weekend's episode of our other podcast, The New Washington. We'll be right back.
I'm Jonathan Swan. I'm a White House reporter for the New York Times. I have a pretty unsentimental view of what we do. Our job as reporters is to dig out information that powerful people don't want published, to take you into rooms that you would not otherwise have access to understand how some of the big decisions shaping our country are being made. And then, painstakingly, to go back and check with sources, check with public documents, make sure the information is correct. This is not something you can outsource to AI. There's no robot that can go and talk to someone who was in the Situation Room and find out what was really said. In order to get actually original information that's not public, that requires human sources, we actually need journalists to do that. So as you may have gathered from this long riff, I'm asking you to consider subscribing to the New York Times. Independent journalism is important, and without you, we simply can't do it.
Here's what else you need to know today.
So I just wanted to perhaps make more of a statement than an explanation.
On Thursday afternoon, White House Chief of Staff John Kelly walked into the White House briefing room for an unscheduled speech.
Most Americans don't know what happens when we lose one of our soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, or Coast Guardsmen in combat. So let me tell you what happens. Their buddies wrap them up in whatever passes as a shroud, puts them on a helicopter as a routine, and sends them home.
In emotional remarks, Kelly defended Trump's phone call to the widow of a U.S. soldier killed in Niger, LaDavid Johnson, days after Johnson's widow, Maisha, criticized the president for telling her that her husband, quote, knew what he was signing up for.
There's no perfect way to make that phone call. When I took this job and talked to President Trump about how to do it, My first recommendation was he not do it because it's not the phone call that parents, family members are looking forward to.
Kelly, a retired general, recalled the death of his own son, Second Lieutenant Robert Kelly, who was killed in Afghanistan in 2010, saying he never received a condolence call from then President Obama.
That was not a criticism. That was just to simply say, I don't believe President Obama called. That's not a negative thing. I don't believe President Bush called in all cases. I don't believe any president, particularly when the casualty rates are very, very high, that presidents call. But I believe they're all right.
Kelly said he was heartbroken by the criticism of Trump and singled out Congresswoman Frederica Wilson of Florida, who said she heard Trump's call with Johnson's widow and described it as insensitive.
And when I listened to this woman and what she was saying and what she was doing on TV, the only thing I could do to collect my thoughts was to go walk among the finest men and women on this earth. And you can always find them because they're in Arlington National Cemetery.
The Daily is produced by Theo Balcom, Lindsay Garrison, Rachel Quester, Annie Brown, Andy Mills, Christopher Worth, and Ike Sriskandaraja, with editing help from Larissa Anderson. Lisa Tobin is our executive producer. Samantha Hennig is our editorial director. Brad Fisher is our technical manager. Our theme music is by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsverk of Wonderly. Special thanks to Peter Sale, Sam Dolnick, Michaela Bouchard, and Wendy Dore. That's it for The Daily. I'm Michael Barbaro. See you Monday.